Wisconsin is no stranger to political protest, as that moment from the 2011 Capitol protest indicates. But a new survey from NBC News and the Wall Street Journal asked Americans whether they were upset enough about any issue to get out there and protest. And 57% of those sampled said yes, they were mad as heck, and they were ready to do something about it.
But that 57% number would actually be pretty good voter turnout in most years. Far fewer Americans will probably go out and participate in any form of protest.
So here's the question. What motivates us to protest, or what keeps us from doing it? David Meyer is an expert on political protest. He is a professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. He blogs at Politics Outdoors, and his books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. David, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
I want to start out with the specific question in the poll. It was, is there something that upsets you enough that if you could, you would carry a protest sign for a day? 57% of the Americans said yes to that very low level of protest. But do we have a sense of how many Americans actually engage in any form of public protest?
When they take polls about have you ever participated in protest, we get numbers between a quarter and 35-40% have ever participated in a protest. And as won't surprise you out in Madison, it's not an average. There are plenty of people who turn out all the time and plenty of people for whom it's just an occasional thing. So 57% is huge. Everybody's willing to protest. Everybody wants to go on a diet. Everybody wants to exercise. But you need the opportunity and just a little bit of extra motivation to actually get out there and do it.
And I'm wondering, maybe you can help me out with this, how does that number compare with other periods in American history? You know, people think of the 60s, of course, but, you know, there were protests in the labor movements in the 30s. There are all kinds of other eras where people were out in the streets, or so it seemed. Do we have any indication of what those numbers may have looked like?
Yeah, it's a much smaller percentage of the American population in the past than it is now.
Really?
Protest has spread to far more causes further across the political spectrum than ever before. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't more dramatic instances of protest at, you know, imagine, you know, at times in our history. There certainly are, you know, in the 1930s and the 1960s, mass civil disobedience, huge demonstrations. But I think we tend to forget the variety of varieties of activism that are going on right now. There are, you know, I mean, just in the last few days, we've read about anti-immigration protesters showing up at these centers housing immigrant children, and immigrant rights protesters showing up at the same places to counter-demonstrate. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've had that court decision about an ongoing protest outside a women's health clinic in Boston, Massachusetts. So when we look back at the labor protests of the 30s or the civil rights or anti-war protests of the 60s, we tend to forget about all the different things that are going on right now.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because it kind of tells me that while more people, there's all these causes, at the same time, if people are devoting energy to a certain cause, it means they can't devote energy to another cause. And so, well, there may be more protests, it's more diffuse in a way.
Absolutely. There are more, you know, I did a little study of protests at political conventions. You know, when they have the conventions in 2016, you know, activists are going to show up outside the Republican convention and protest every issue under the sun, and same thing at the Democratic convention. Well, this goes back ever since there are conventions. But in the old days, there would tend to be one or two overarching issues. And nowadays, it's a laundry list represented by a whole range of different groups. And the kind of interesting movements of the last several years have embraced a laundry list within. And I'm thinking about the Tea Party on the right and Occupy on the left. And you say, well, what was the Tea Party about? You know, there are lots of answers to that. The Tea Party was about limited government. The Tea Party was about social conservatism. The Tea Party was about repealing the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. And you ask, what was Occupy about? And we can say this overarching thing about political and economic inequality, but if you read through any of the Occupy manifestos, there must be a different word for pluralizing manifesto.
But, manifesti or something.
Manifesti, yes. If you read through all of them, there's a boatload of issues. There are a lot of things that people are concerned about. And one thing doesn't come out and unify them unless there's a lot of organizing work to do it or unless there's some sort of crisis unifying people. So, I mean, oh, by the way, remember Keystone? There's still protests on both sides of that issue going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suspect the other little piece of this story, which has got to be very familiar to you in Wisconsin, is we have frequent elections in America. And if people think that they can get what they want through elections, they're likely to engage in electoral activity in addition to or instead of demonstrating out in the streets. And my read, and you can tell me if this is true in Wisconsin, is that there's a lot of focus on the election as a vehicle for getting what you want.
I would say there's a lot of focus on the election right now, and we will see how it all turns out. Earlier you said, you know, when people want to protest, when they're thinking about this, they need the opportunity and they need the motivation. Talk a little bit more about that, and then maybe try to take that from the individual into a larger group. How does it become something that becomes larger than just one lone person out there?
Well, there are saints and psychopaths who are going to turn out to protest no matter what, and they're going to self-recruit, and they're going to make their own signs, and they're going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we admire the saints, and we are a little nervous around the psychopaths, but we've seen them if we've ever been to demonstrations. We've seen them both. Most people, however, have to think that protest has a possibility of helping them get what they want, and it's the best possibility they have for getting what they want. In other words, for most people, if you can get what you want by sending a check to, name your cause, you're likely to do that, or pulling a lever in the voting booth, you're likely to do that. You protest when you think it's necessary and potentially effective. And most people are not self-recruiters. Most people get recruited. Actually, the best predictor of who shows up is who gets asked personally. And, you know, that takes dedicated organizing. That takes people going around, going to meetings, in the modern era, sending out emails, posting stuff on websites, organizing events. Sometimes it means knocking on doors. Sometimes it means getting a parade permit and reserving a sound system and printing flyers. And that's a large investment of effort. It usually takes money, though not always. It always takes substantial labor. And that doesn't happen by itself. You know, I mean, when you read the poll, and that was a great way to start the show, thank you. When you read the poll, there's this premise that if people are unhappy, then protest automatically materializes. But it actually takes a lot of organizing to make things happen. And right now, let's look at the big organizations that have mounted protest movements in the past. Well, organized labor is desperately trying to defend itself. And, you know, Wisconsin's not the only story there, but it's certainly the signal one. The Tea Party groups and the people who funded the Tea Party groups are heavily, heavily, heavily invested in the election instead. Okay, so those are groups on the left and right that are working other routes to try to get what they want right now or to protect what they already have. And then, you know, I'm just thinking about, like, the whole range of issues we've seen in the last couple of years and how it's hard to build a broad coalition around any of them. You know, I mean, gun politics are still a big issue in much of the United States, but it's not something that trumps every other issue for most people.
All right, we're going to take a couple of moments here and take a break, and when we return, we'll continue talking to sociologist David Meyer about political protest in the United States, what motivates people to protest or what keeps them from doing it.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation about political protest and why Americans get involved or not. Our guest is David Meyer, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest.
And you can call now at 800-642-1234 with your questions or to share your experiences. Have you gone out and protested something? Maybe in the last few years, maybe back in the 60s. 800-642-1234. Or have you helped organize a protest? Do you want to tell us how unspontaneous those things are? How much work goes in behind the scenes? Love to hear your story. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
David, before the break, you were talking about how people, when they get together to protest, see it as sort of a means to an end. And you could look at that and say, well, they're being very opportunistic, that this is a good way to go, or they're desperate, that there is no other way to go. Do you know which one of those two paths are chosen most often?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think people who protest usually do other things as well. And I think just because it's a means to an end doesn't mean it's not something that you get something else out of. So if I go to a restaurant, I need to nourish myself, but I hope to enjoy the food. If I want to protest about nuclear power in 1979 and there's this added bonus that Bruce Springsteen is going to play, well, those two things are synergistic and work together. And a smart organizer will play on both of those things simultaneously. You know, I mean, one of the crazy things about your protests in Madison just, I guess, 2 years ago,
mm-hmm.
is even though it was really cold and really desperate, it looked like people were having some fun at the same time. And it looked like they were feeling some satisfaction in connecting with others who shared their values.
And I would say, I would add to that by saying that there was a lot of organization I know that took place, and there were, you know, entertainers of one kind or another who were out there, and it went on over a fantastic period of time. And you think about the work that went into that, it was really impressive in that regard. One other question I want to ask before we get to calls, you know, people all over the world these days are protesting about something. Is there something unique about the way Americans protest, or is a protest a protest a protest no matter where you go?
You know, I wish I had something systematic about this, but I don't. What I've discovered in, you know, just selected attendance of meetings, you know, in different countries, is that American activists tend to be relentlessly pragmatic. They tend to talk about, like, how do we do what we need to do to make this thing happen? And, you know, that's what Tocqueville said defines Americans. I also think that, and I don't want to sugarcoat this or make this sound too soft, but Americans are relatively tolerant of protest as a political activity. Now, that this doesn't mean, I mean, I know enough about American history, we all do, to know that the American government has stomped down harshly on occasion on protesters who were carrying unpopular causes. That said, if you walk down in front of the White House or, you know, Capitol Hill, you'll see somebody holding a sign who won't be cleared out. You know, we're more tolerant than we give ourselves credit for, and less tolerant than we ought to be.
Let's go to the phones now and see what listeners have to say. We begin in Brookfield, and Dawn joins us. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was involved in the Iraq War protests that happened in Milwaukee around a lot of coffins being draped with flags, and felt very strongly to be there. It was the first time that I've ever protested, and if I feel strongly in something like that, I will definitely do it again.
So let me ask you this, Dawn. I mean, what was the trigger for you? What was the moment when you said, you know, I've seen enough, I have to go do something?
I think it was the, to be quite honest, the lack of publicity around how many people were dying at the time, how many soldiers. they would put some ads in the Milwaukee Journal, not ads, but, you know, publications of, you know, a little article on who passed away from Wisconsin. And I thought, well, if Wisconsin has this many, then the nation as a whole is mourning. And it was made very light of, you know, there was no go out and do something for your country, you know, like they used to have war bonds and things like that. And I think the lack of publicity around how many people were actually being killed just really bothered me, and especially the fact that the Iraqi war was unnecessary.
All right, Dawn, thanks for those comments. And David Meyer, do you hear that story a lot, that there's an individual and one moment, all of a sudden there's something that just has sort of built up over time, and now they have to move from reading into action?
That's the way people tell the story, but there's always accumulation. You know, I mean, when we tell stories about ourselves, we make it dramatic. We set up critical moments. You know, the moment our eyes met, then I knew. But there's always a long history that leads up to those dramatic moments. And the war protests that Dawn talked about, that's a really great and very, very disturbing example of how protest relates to policy. I mean, Dawn talked about war bonds. You know, in previous eras, when we had a draft, many, many, many American families would be touched by a war. And in the last wars that we fought in Afghanistan and Iraq, a very small portion, tiny sliver of the American population, has borne huge costs for conducting those wars. And it's allowed other Americans to turn away from it and pay attention to the other issues of the moment or their lives. So the absence of a draft is something that stopped that protest movement from continuing forever. The other thing that was strange is when your guy is president, it's a little harder to get people out in the streets. When President Obama took office running against the wars, the number of self-identified Democrats at those demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations, began to decline. And you saw much more vociferous opposition to deficit spending when Obama was in office than we did when George W. Bush was in office, who is also a great deficit spender. When your guy is in office, you tend to give him a little bit of a break. And that kind of limits the growth of movements sometimes.
As you look ahead to the future, and I'm thinking kind of partly of the social media aspect, and you talked about, you know, sort of the sheer number of things that are being protest now. What, in your estimation, does the future of protest look like? Is it going to be continuing to divide more and more and more? Or do you think there will be a coming together over larger causes? Or is it really impossible to tell?
I have my favorite picks about what comes up next, but I'm usually wrong about that. So I think that there is still an overriding concern with economic inequality, which has been taken up by mainstream politicians, as Standard & Poor's released a report about how economic inequality hurts the GDP. So that seems like that's something possible. I always wonder about educational access, which always seems like a salient issue to me, but, you know, I live in a university, so maybe I've got a distorted view of that. I always see those things as potentially overarching links. But, you know, the world just offers continual surprises. Nobody predicted the Tea Party. Nobody predicted Occupy, or the people who predicted it 20 times before it happened. So I wish I knew.
Well, that's a pretty good way to leave it. And when the next big one comes up, we'll have you on and talk about it. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. He blogs at Politics Outdoors.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.